KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, when San Francisco District 6 Supervisor Chris Daley reportedly brought up the question of Mayor Newsom's cocaine use at a public supervisor meeting. The mayor, by the way, vehemently denied it. A firestorm ensued in the media. Much discussion ensued about what the boundaries ought to be as far as public discourse. Do we need guidelines for civility in the public realm, in the blogosphere, in our daily lives? We'll discuss civility with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. In a San Francisco Board of Supervisors meeting a couple of weeks ago, San Francisco Board of Supervisor Chris Daley leveled allegations of cocaine use against Mayor Gavin Newsom, charges the mayor categorically denied. The media, according to Supervisor Daley, overplayed the incident, but it clearly hit a nerve. Even former San Francisco mayor and California Senator Dianne Feinstein spoke out against inappropriate crossing of lines in the public sphere, and many lamented the episode as being all too revealing of the sinking of civility in public discourse. A recent Wall Street Journal editorial wrote of civility as a public virtue, a necessary social commodity that allows society to function. In the world of the blogosphere, where anonymity is commonplace and accountability often absent, there are ongoing attempts to establish codes of conduct and guidelines that will ensure greater civility. Many argue against such codes or guidelines as a potential assault on or erosion of First Amendment rights. Civility is what we'll discuss this hour in politics and cyberspace and in our everyday lives as citizens. And we're going to be joined in the course of the hour by a number of people, including Don Hanlon Johnson, the author of a book called Everyday Hopes, Utopian Dreams, and former Supervisor Tony Hall and present San Francisco Supervisor Michaela Alioto-Pierre. But first, we're going to talk with James Donahue and Lisa Stone. James Donahue is President and Professor of Ethics at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you aboard. And also with us, Lisa Stone here in studio, co-founder of BlogHer. It's a women's media company that's located in Palo Alto. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Jim Donahue, let me begin with you. And I guess the real question here is, as these things continue to slide, that is, as the lack of civility becomes more and more apparent or more and more conspicuous, what do we do to ameliorate that? What do we do to ensure that maybe civility will play a role?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to understand why the decline in civility continues to flourish, why people are less and less inclined to be kind, to be decent, to be respectful, to be gracious of one another. And many commentators have noted that we live in a time of excessive self-interest and excessive individualism, where the focal point of our world is ourself. And the self, what we do typically is to try to gain advantage for the self and to advance our own positions in ways that are going to put us ahead of others.
So the culture of narcissism.
Yeah, the culture of narcissism, the culture of individualism, et cetera. So if that's this, if we presume that that is at play at some level, and I wouldn't say that's the entire definition, the issue then is what do you do about it? How do you, what tempers, if you will, what tempers self-interest? What tempers excess?
What tempers tempers?
What restrains tempers? And I think historically what has tempered excess or self-interest have been relationships, have been institutions, have been communities, have been various practices that exist in a society that serve to provide some set of parameters or constraints that are going to enable or require people to be mindful, to be respectful, to not be taken by their own self-interest in an absolute
kind of way.
But
one could easily bring in the argument that the institutions are in decline as
well.
Well,
the institutions are definitely in transformation, and I would say they're in decline, which gives us an opportunity to talk about how to reconstruct these institutions, be it the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, whether it be schools, whether it be churches, synagogues, whether it be civic associations. So I think the real focus of our conversation has to be on how we reconstruct our institutions and our relationships in ways that will introduce more effective ways of putting some limits and some tempers, if you will, on excessive or unbridled self-interest.
We're dealing with a phenomenon, though. I think you've certainly outlined a lot of where we need to go with this, but demonizing. I mean, it happens, certainly it happens in the world of the media very commonly. I was thinking, in fact, and before thinking through this program, about arguments we used to get into, and we used to call Talk Show 101. We'd have people on who would be advocating choice and advocating the opposite, pro-life, as they call themselves. And they'd see themselves respectively as baby killers and as those who were inhibiting them against choice. And so it would become personal, which this whole thing with Dalia Newsom apparently did. Or you have people who are arguing about Israel and Palestine, and they take it personally, and they bring it to a level of, you're demonic.
They not only take it personally, but they also take the position that if I'm right, you must be wrong, or if you're right, I must be wrong. So it gets personal because people feel affronted by the fact that they might be wrong, or this very, I think, simplistic notion that things are black and white, they're right and wrong, and the idea then gets played out that people say that if you're advancing a position against me, then you are saying you're right and therefore I'm wrong. So when you get pushed into that corner, you're going to try to come back in ways that are not going to be terribly respectful of other people, respectful of your partner or your opponent in the conversation. So the issue then is to find ways of having a much more, say, differentiated understanding of how claims in public play out, how different positions get advanced that are seen as contributions to the conversation, but not necessarily be the absolute defining position about what is right and what is wrong.
Well, the Burgess's
is
where
you only have two options, and there's only two options, and you're either a winner or a loser.
There's this idea of constructive confrontation that comes from the Burgesses. That's really what we're talking about here, isn't it?
How to disagree in public, how to build argument in ways that are going to advance and construct public positions. I think frequently what we see is opinions flying around, being tossed from one person to another. And as a professor of ethics, one thing I always distinguish is the difference between reasoned argument that's constructed in public on the one hand versus throwing opinions around and having opinions count as more than just that, personal opinion. And so our public discourse becomes very attenuated and, I think, diminished by the fact that we don't have a clear sense of how you construct arguments in public, how you disagree in public, and how you take into account the positions that are contrary to your own.
We need to draw lines, though. That's what you're saying.
You need to draw lines, and you need to, I think, have pretty clear rules of engagement. One of the things we can talk about later is that I think every institution has to have a clear sense of what the rules of engagement are, whether it be blogs, and Lisa and I were talking about this before, about blog in the blog sphere, what constitute the rules of engagement for participating? What constitute the rules of engagement for the Board of Supervisors? What is discourse to look like here? And then determining whose responsibility it is to put that together. And then I think the most fundamental issue is having a sense of accountability to something other than yourself or your own position. And what you have accountability to is the institution, to the public trust, to this Board of Supervisors, to this institution, to this church, to this mosque, to this synagogue, etc.
You can think that you're being accountable and at the same time feel that part of that accountability is ad hominem attack. I'm sure that Supervisor Daly, whatever the extent of his attack was on the mayor, felt that he was serving the interests of his constituency and those who were being cut back in terms of revenue for drug programs or for alcohol rehabilitation programs.
Then the burden is on him to determine in what way that is so. Why? Where does his notion of the public trust come from, and what does that notion allow, and what is the data that, or the evidence, if you will, that would support that notion? And if those are the terms of engagement for the Board of Supervisors, then it has to be clear that this is in bounds or out of bounds.
James Donahue again is president and professor of ethics at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. Lisa Stone is co-founder of Blogger. It's a women's media company, and It's based in Palo Alto, and she's been proposing a blogger code of conduct for, well, actually, you go back about 10 years in terms of working on guidelines and working with online companies and all of that sort of thing. And whenever you talk about guidelines in the blogosphere, the hackles come up immediately and say, First Amendment, First Amendment.
Oh, and mine do too. I'm a huge First Amendment rightist, particularly as someone who started in traditional journalism and was at the Oakland Tribune before I went to CNN. I have to say, passionate disagreement is what the blogosphere is very much all about. We actually call our code a community guideline, because I don't believe, and my partners don't believe, that one code of conduct could work for every blog. There's no reason, or one community, there's no reason that a community talking about the Iraq War should be held to the same standards as a community talking about, you know, activities for kids ages 3 to 10. So on our blog and our community at blogger.com, we just have two rules. Number one is we believe passionately in civil disagreement. Attack each other's ideas, absolutely. But we don't believe in anything that falls under the category of unacceptable content. And we define unacceptable content as anything that includes hate speech, plagiarism, violates third-party privacy, anything that would essentially fall under the basic tenets of good journalism. So when we're talking here about what happened at the San Francisco City Hall meeting, and we're talking about Daley versus Newsom, I think we have a situation here where it sounds like the Board of Supervisors don't have great ground rules, because unless Mr. Daley has some bona fide proof of drug abuse by the mayor, that's slander. And it turns out that that's against the law. And there are laws on the books. There are cyber-stalking laws on the books in 45 states that make certain kinds of egregious hate speech illegal.
Well, you were talking about Chris Daley's blog, his personal blog, and saying that the way he comported himself there rhetorically was not all that different than what came across in the meeting in the Board of Supervisors at City Hall.
You're right. I was not at the board meeting, but I've watched the video, I've listened to the audio, and I've been following their meetings. And what you see at chrisdaley.org is a pretty fair example of, I think, how he presents himself. And the bottom line is, cyber reality is now today's reality. The way you comport yourself online is going to be reflected back at you in your day-to-day work. And I think that's why what Dr. Donahoe is saying about needing to have a way you're going to interact with each other in a long-term way in order to actually develop public policy for the city of San Francisco is extremely valuable. It's great that these guys are blowing each other up every day, but what is that actually doing for our city?
But there are those who say that cyberspace is different. It's like the frontier, and the rules out there are sort of like they were. Well, they're anarchic almost in some ways. In fact, it's almost as if when people get in an automobile, you know, there are all these tests that show that road rage will increase, the level of rage will increase because of road rage. They're in their car. The flaming phenomenon also occurs. People are sitting alone at the screen of their computer, and somehow they behave in ways that are really outrageous. And if you confront them with it face to face, they might even cop to that.
Well, I really think that the first thing to do, and I've written extensively about hate speech online and trolls, as they're called online, and the first thing to do if someone makes a nasty anonymous comment is to ignore it. Unless they've threatened your family's health and human safety, you should ignore it, because trolls, anonymous trolls, people who make comments like that are seeking the spotlight. They're there because they're trying to take some of your sunshine. And if you look at what happened between Mr. Daley and Mr. Newsom, it was like being publicly flamed. The question then for the mayor is, how much of a response do you really want to give this? Either it's slander and you have a legal case, or as the mayor of the city, you need to move forward and set policy for the kinds of meetings that are actually going to move the conversation about health and human services in the Tenderloin, which I believe is a subject that we've all totally been forced to lose sight of because of the way these guys are acting.
That's one of the real losses in all of this. You lose sight of the content often through the personalities and the adversarial stuff that goes on. Lisa Stone, again, is co-founder of Blogher. What about Tim O'Reilly and his code of conduct? He's the Web 2.0 guy who, I guess, is working with Jimmy Wales from Wikipedia. They're trying to come up with a code of conduct?
Yes, I've never met either gentleman, but I was very complimented that they really like Blogher's community guidelines. And those, by the way, are on the bottom of every page at blogher.com. But again, I think the difference is that we really feel like every community has to come up with their own. What works for your forum website is going to be very different from what works on blog her, for example, possibly. And it's important not to slam one rule down across the entire blogosphere. That doesn't feel like the First Amendment to me.
Blogger, by the way, is B-L-O-G-H-E-R, capital H-E-R. Don Hanlon Johnson's with us from Mill Valley. He's professor of semantics at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, author of Everyday Hopes, Utopian Dreams, and it's a memoir essentially about his growing up in Sacramento, hanging out with Joan Didion and getting Jesuit training there. And Don, glad to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
You write a lot about manners and etiquette, and actually a funny anecdote about your parents responding very formally to a Halloween party that you were invited to and dressing you up like a little Lord Fauntleroy. But manners, in many people's minds, that's equivalent to civility. That is, if you're selfish or rude or inconsiderate, it's just bad manners.
As I listened to you and Lisa and James, I was thinking about how I was raised my whole life within rules of conduct, the rules of conduct of Emily Post, and then in the Jesuit religious order, extremely refined rules of conduct that governed every item of our behavior, from how we held our hands to how we acted with other people. And I saw, because I was raised for so many years in that atmosphere, how rules of conduct only go so far. And I thought of this famous quote of St. Augustine, who says, love and do whatever you want. And the trivial reading of that is, just love and do whatever you want. But the long history of interpreting that argument of Augustine's is that if you're in touch with the love within you and with the caring for other people, then your behavior will follow that impulse. And it's not predictable exactly what that will take. Now, as I thought about that, I thought, well, what's lacking in this vitriolic culture? There's a need for tapping into our respect for each other and our need to listen to each other. That's not clear what kinds of rules that will produce. So that was one of my reflections on what we have to recover in our culture, a sense of communal respect and a communal sensitivity.
What about morality? Jim Donahue is here to talk about ethics with us, but you point out in your book, I was thinking about St. Augustine since you mentioned him, going to Carthage, burning and all that, but
right.
I don't mean that kind of morality.
Right.
I'm not talking about lust here. I'm talking about what you call the Christian conflation between etiquette and moral virtue,
right,
often mistaken for each other.
Right. I think that's an extremely important point. I was also thinking of Rush Limbaugh, who, since my memoir is about Sacramento, Rush Limbaugh, I don't know if you know this, was originally a reporter on KFBK in Sacramento, and he went on to be very famous, and part of his success is due to being nasty. So people are now paid, and they're successful politically and financially for being nasty. So I think the success, the big question is, why are people paying for nastiness?
Why
are they rewarding that?
I think a very important question. Why the fame and wealth of someone like Ann Coulter?
Yes.
Comes immediately to mind. I'm going to go to a couple of our local officials here. Michaela Alioto Pierce with us. She's Supervisor District 2 in San Francisco. And Michaela, first of all, I should say Supervisor Alioto Pierce. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Michaela's fine.
Tell us about your response to this whole brouhaha at City Hall.
Well, we have gone through this before, something like it, and we are trying to deal with it. You know, it's very interesting. I think your guests have really hit on a lot of different important topics. One of them is the fact that, Supervisor Daley, and I think that it's important to say, is that he was reelected in November, and he was reelected after, after I had put forward a motion to have him censured about a year and a half ago, after his incident with a police officer where he yelled at him, after his altercation with Mayor Brown in the office, after, he usurped the mayor's powers and appointed someone to the PUC. So his behavior has been somewhat constant, and, at the same time, I'm not saying that it isn't outrageous. But what we're doing at the board right now is we're putting together a code of conduct to deal with it at the board. But we can only go so far. There is a part of this that is up to the voters. If you don't like the way someone acts, then you need to vote against those actions. And at the board right now, through the code of conduct, we're actually looking at a formal way of censuring someone, which we currently don't have. It would take three different parts, three different levels. First, you could be admonished, you could be sanctioned, and then the third and the most severe would be a censure, which would have a punitive response to whatever actions a member of the board took.
And is it your hope that that will enhance civility and make people more civil toward each other?
It's a hope. San Francisco is a funny place. I worked in Washington.
It's an understatement, of course.
It is an understatement. I worked for Gore for 3 years in Washington, D.C., and we dealt with the Gingrich administration quite frequently, and as we all know, they were big adversaries. We certainly were not friends, but there was a level of respect, and there was certainly conversations that took place between the two offices that you don't see at the Board of Supervisors. We don't see that same level of respect, and we should. San Francisco deserves it. San Francisco deserves to have conversations that are meaningful, that are based on issues that really impact them. I think that your comments about this being an ad hominem attack are, you know, they are, it's point on. All of a sudden, you're losing track of what we're really discussing, which are cuts to the public health system. They were very important things to be discussing. And that all went to the wayside because of accusations that were leveled. And so some people argue that it was passion. The problem with that type of quote passion is that you really lose the meaning behind what you're trying to accomplish, which is securing good medical attention and care for the poor. You know, and one thing that is not mentioned is that Supervisor Daley, after his attack on the mayor, walked out of the committee hearing, and the rest of us sat there for another 4 hours and listened to public comment on these items. And in some ways, that's just as egregious. When you have 200 people who come to talk to the board because they're concerned with things, and a member of the board gets up and walks out and says, oh, I've already heard this before, I don't need to hear it again.
Michaela Eliotta-Peer, again, a supervisor, District 2, and we thank her for joining us, and thank you so much, Supervisor.
Thank you, Michael.
I want to get Tony Hall on here, former supervisor and candidate for mayor of San Francisco. And Tony, your
Hi,
thoughts?
Michael.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. Interested to hear what you have to say about civility, which is what we're talking about this morning.
Well, there's a lot of good comments being made on this show. You know, the whole thing about civility is if you conduct yourself in a civil manner, it usually comes back to you. It's kind of a circle, if you know what I mean. If we conduct ourselves in a manner that begets civility, it usually comes back. Personal allegations. Not accusations. I didn't see Daley's comments as an accusation. I saw it as an allegation that may or may not be true. And let's take a good look at this, because it seems to be a lot of comments here about Daley, who I've had my own tussles with him. He's a very passionate young man.
Tony, hold that thought for a moment, because
sure.
We're coming up on a break, and I want to give out the phone number. I know there are many of you who would like to join us in this discussion about civility. And, in fact, I'm looking at some emails here, and someone says, today is the age of civility, and crusty old cranks like to complain. That's not what we're doing here, I hope. What we're talking about is a constructive dialogue that will help perhaps bring civility into greater light and get rid of some of the heat and make more light. You can join us, and we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, you can call us now from wherever you're listening to us, or however, radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, or send an email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're looking at personal and public civility in this hour, and Lisa Stone's with us here in studio, the co-founder of Blogger, and James Donahue, president and professor of ethics at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. We spoke with Don Hanlon-Johnson, professor of semantics at the California Institute of Integral Studies and author of Everyday Hopes, Utopian Dreams. And we also spoke with Supervisor Michaela Eliotta-Peer, who is Supervisor District 2 in San Francisco. And Tony Hall is with us on the line, former supervisor and candidate for mayor in the city of San Francisco. And Tony, we had to go to the break there, and you were opining about, the whole incident involving Daley. But before we get back to that, and we're going to go to our callers and emailers, Jim Donahue was saying off air that sometimes civility, in fact, and often, many cases, civility doesn't necessarily come back to you. If you act civil to people, they don't necessarily respond in kind, or maybe you need some kind of institutional or community framework to make sure that there's at least some rules operating in terms of ensuring that they will respond in kind.
Are you asking me a question, Michael?
That's a question, Tony, yes.
Okay, well,
it's not like a statement, but it's a question. In other words, you had said that you act civil people, the civility will come back, and I just wondered what you...
Well, normally that's the case and has been the case throughout humankind. Today's world is a world we're living in involves a high degree of spin, and legislators and people on the Board of Supervisors, since this seems to be what it's about, they have to get their position out in 5 to 10 second sound bites, which the media promotes. Today's world, you know, the more dramatic, the more shock involved those sound bites are, the more exposure they get. In the case of Chris Daly, I'm against personal attacks based upon allegations. What he said was not an accusation, but an allegation, which may or may not have been true. Mr. Newsom has been the subject of rumors for at least 3 to 4 years that I know of about his speculated drug dependency or substance abuse. However, let's look at it from both sides of the coin. What Daly said may have been a hit below the belt, an allegation. What I saw ensue in the 2 weeks that followed that by the Newsom camp against this young, passionate man was uncivil to the highest degree. It was character assassination like I've never seen in San Francisco that the Newsom camp, through the newspapers, through the media, put out against Daly. Now, my question is, where was the civility in that? This is administration that is pretty much ruled by press release, by spin. Daly obviously reacted to that. Unfortunately, what Daly was getting at was lost, and that is that here we have a mayor that's proposing cutting funding for substance abuse, for rehabilitation, while he himself is engaged in that process. Highly hypocritical. But what I saw following Daly's allegation for 2 weeks was the most uncivil behavior of any political machine that I've witnessed in 40 years.
Well, even if civility doesn't breed more civility, one can safely say aphoristically that uncivility or incivility breeds more uncivility. And Tony Hall, thanks for joining us this morning. Good to hear from you, former supervisor and candidate for mayor. And we'll go to our callers and find out what you have to say. Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org. Just a couple of emails here. Before we go to your calls, this is a listener, Bill, who says, media outlets that give access to the airwaves by cretins like Ann Coulter are as much a part of the problem as the spewers of bile. If you let her on the air because of the LCD ratings effect benefits your bottom line, you cheapen the public discourse. Having crap like that given credence by being placed in the same setting as actual reasoned discourse taints the whole pool. And here's Kenneth, who says, I believe there should be no limits on criticism as long as there is no slander. If we shy away from criticism in the name of civility, we will let problems fester, if only so no one's feelings are hurt. I work for a Bay Area company that punishes outspokenness, criticism, and passion. My company is suffering for it because no one points out where the problems are. Lisa Stone, we're not just talking about politeness here. I mean, there should be good reasoned argument, passionate argument, adversarial argument. We're talking about drawing lines or boundaries around not only slander, but maybe just kind of ad hominem attacks that we're talking about and cruelty and unnecessary malice.
Well, it's true that on our community at blogger.com, we are completely committed to passionate disagreement, but we are not interested in anything that has to do with harassment, hate speech, stalking, anything of the kind. I think that the challenge posed by our current environment today is in an environment where an Ann Coulter and that kind of behavior is going to churn ratings. How do you develop a community with a sort of longstanding value where people can talk about things that really matter without defaulting to the cheap attack? There is a lot to be said for anyone who has decided to turn away that kind of criticism on their show. And I think that the most important thing that should be asked is, if someone is going to criticize the way a community is handling itself, then how would they improve it? So for former supervisor Tony Hall, I would like to know what he as mayor would do to raise the tone at city council meetings, a tone that frankly has devolved into people who need time out in a corner, I say as a mother, and a need to bring the city back to focus on how we're going to take better care of the health and human services needed in the Tenderloin.
Well, one would say that is better, for example, on the national level. I mean, there's a lot of partisan bickering, there's a lot of acrimony, but Jim Donahue, I mean, you look at Congress versus, say, the local Board of Supervisors, and they comport themselves with some degree of greater civility, you know, madam and sir and all that sort of thing. Some of it's just outer cosmetic stuff, but I guess the real question here is, you called it a culture of narcissism. It's also a culture of sensation, and sensation does increase ratings. It does increase book sales. It does also get attention.
In a world of consumerism, where the market becomes the barometer and the broker for what counts, what doesn't count, what gets determined as right, or what gets time and airplay, you do rely on the market for to sort these things out. And I think that's a very imperfect mechanism for sorting these things out. I think at the national level, you have in the United States Congress and in sort of public affairs nationally, you do have more of a sort of an accepted rules of engagement. But I'm not sure the market will always bear, or will always go, and will always favor those who are producing ratings, or those who are producing more of an audience. The question is, there needs to be the market's problematic because it doesn't deal with issues like inequalities. It doesn't deal with excesses. It doesn't deal with the unfairness that occurs because of the market. And that's where the problem is. So trying to find ways of regulating the market without being overly intrusive, and I wouldn't argue for being overly regulatory, but there's got to be some way of having more than the market as a way of sorting out what's going to hold, what's going to be allowed and not allowed. I've always felt that
are you arguing against the free market here?
No, I'm arguing against the free market's inability to solve certain issues. I think that its inability to solve, to protect vulnerable people, vulnerable groups, is a huge issue. To necessarily address issues of inequality and power. I think the market is not effective at that. It's effective at certain things. But for me, I'd say one of the issues about free speech is the answer to bad free speech or hate speech is more speech, better speech, and not less speech.
Well, in fact, to take a slightly different perspective, I really think that right now we're seeing that the free market is not supporting what Chris Daly is doing or what he's doing on his blog. ChrisDaly.org has very few comments. Many of them are against his behavior at City Hall. And if you go to the San Francisco Chronicle's message boards and you look at what people are saying about what happened in City Hall that day, they're extremely turned off. And I think that in this case, the marketplace are voters. And I think that voters are looking for solutions for the city, and they want the city council to set a tone where everyone can engage in civil disagreement and then go out and fix things.
Well, Supervisor Daly has his own constituency, and if the reporting was accurate, when he came in and gave his oration and his dramatic flourishes, histrionics, whatever it was, there was all kinds of cheering and you know, almost bellicose. People respond sometimes to this kind of drama and to adversarial drama particularly, and it gets bellicose and it gets passionate and it gets out of control, and sometimes people like it. It's like raw meat.
Mm-hmm. Passion, drama, you're absolutely right. It's something that people...
I think commercial talk radio has been so successful.
Exactly. But this issue of adversarialism is something that's very internalized into some of our professional structures. The legal system, the world of business, that are premised on certain types of adversarialism for the market to be effective. And so the adversarialism becomes permeating of other arenas, such as the political arena. And so adversarialism becomes part of the public virtue. It becomes part of the habit, the public habit or the public manner. And so we see it, and it shows itself, and then we say, wow, how did we get there? and what can we do about it? And I think that's where these issue of rules of engagement and trying for each community and in each institution to be able to address these issues and negotiate these internally to that institution are absolutely critical.
And we go to our callers. And Kathy, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. This is a fascinating conversation. I have one quick comment. And I think, you know, it takes on a whole nother life when you become a victim of this. I happen to be one plain little old stressed out mom here in Union City trying to fight for the rights of a daughter who is in the seventh grade reading at the fourth grade. So we've got this IEP thing going on with our school district. And so I don't have the press. I'm just one plain old mom. Nobody's going to listen to me. But my question is, or comment is, what do you do as a common citizen when the institution that you're fighting against, who is more powerful and has more resources, resorts to incivility, condones it? They, are uncivil in order to protect the institution or their resources.
Jim Donahue.
Presents
an ethical quandary.
That's a great question. You can absent yourself from the system, which is not always a viable alternative. You can protest the system and try to change it and transform it. Although, as you mentioned, the resources of the system frequently are disproportionate to one's own to have the kind of power. Or you can mobilize from within. So I just think there's a number of different strategies you can employ. I'm not saying they're all successful, but they are the mechanisms you have to address it.
Good luck to you, Kathy, and thank you for the call this morning. And we're going to go right to some more of your calls here. And did you have something you want to say, Lisa Stone?
I just think Kathy should start a blog and start writing about exactly what is happening and reaching out to other women online who have children who are struggling with reading or other learning issues. Many of us do. Many of us write about it. And if she gets a letter from the school district or a call she doesn't like, she can chronicle it in the blog and she'll get support from the community, some suggestions, and maybe the local reporter will pick it up.
Women are generally, in blogs, targeted a lot more. That's a fact, isn't it?
There is no question, Michael, that this is in many ways a microcosm of society because women are much more likely, in my experience, to get hate speech, to get nasty comments, and to get even illegal kinds of threats. But I don't know any woman in any newsroom I've ever worked in of prominence who hasn't come under that kind of attack.
More of your calls. John, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yes. In the 1970s, I came across this problem and thought a lot about it and dug down sort of try to figure out what's going on. I traveled across, in my qualifications are that I traveled across the United States for 3 months and stayed with people that I'd met on computers at that time because of the Plato system. Not only that, but I can't type that fast now, but my typing back then went from 30 words per minute to 90 words per minute. And this is what I learned. There is a mechanism that most people don't understand about the written word on the Internet. And what it is that it lacks emotional content and the clues that you see when you hear and see someone's face when you're discussing things. Therefore, it is a natural characteristic of people to actually open up in some way, turn up the rheostats to try to discover what the emotional content really is. And this invariably leads to overreaction unless they understand what's going on. What's more, understanding this mechanism and making it part of the solution is extremely important to solve the problem, because once people know of this mechanism, then they can adjust their reactions to things and act accordingly, and things work much better.
It's interesting. I've never heard it sort of characterized as a mechanism, but this gets back again, Lisa Stone, to this detachment people have when they're sitting alone at their computers. You know?
Yeah, I believe that cyberspace is reality. I think it's important to remember that any comment you make lives on forever, particularly if your name's attached to it. But I also think that if you're hit with a nasty comment or something you feel like you need to respond to, invoke the 24-hour rule, sleep on it, and read your comment aloud after you've made it. It might affect your tone.
Identifying your own emotional content and response is really, really important. the need to necessarily articulate that or verbalize that is a different issue. I think it's absolutely critical that one understands what's at play in terms of passion, in terms of emotion, where one stands on it. But the need to articulate that or share that is a different issue, and there isn't always that need to do that. And I think we sometimes feel, and I think that maybe the blog opens up the possibility for saying things and sharing things that may or may not be necessary to share.
Charles, good morning. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
So I want to make a couple of observations and then ask some of your panelists to comment on this. And these are linked in some way, but they are different in nuance. The first is that over my life, I've observed on many sides of various issues people who become convinced that their viewpoint is so right and so important that civility becomes a weakness, or they feel that by being civil they're caving in, and it often happens to people who feel marginalized. And I've seen this happen on both the left and the right. And then the second is that today in particular, there is an intellectual movement which I don't want to be partisan, but it really comes primarily from the right, which holds that that the very idea that there are multiple viewpoints to be shared is in itself an immoral viewpoint. And I wonder how your panelists would suggest that we address people who have taken these kinds of positions.
Boy, I think those are two salient points. I mean, civility is seen as weakness often. I think the caller's absolutely right. And multiple views are often looked at as being somehow immoral, as he suggests. Jim Donahue.
Yeah, the whole idea that being civil is being a wimp is a little bit of an extreme way of characterizing that. But I think that the problem has to do with the way that our habits and our dispositions and our behaviors are formed over time. How do we come to see that being civilized and respectful is being weak or caving in? That's been formed somewhere. It's been formed in our societies, in our communities, in our institutions.
We've been conditioned.
We've been nurtured, if you will. We've been habituated.
That's better than nurtured.
No, not nurtured. We've been habituated. And that becomes an issue for us to look at. I want to go back to a comment that Don Hanlon Johnson was making about virtue and the whole idea that our habits and our outlooks and the way we behave come to us because we're formed that way over time. We're formed that way in the world that we live in our experiences of growing up and how our institutions acculturate us. And we need to be really focused on how decency and respect and civility becomes that which we are formed in. And I'm not saying it does necessarily all the time, but I think that's the challenge for our institutions these days, is to understand how you incorporate that civility, that fundamental respect, into the formation patterns of our habits of public virtue.
Very challenging indeed. Lisa Stone, you want to add something here?
Well, I love this comment, Christopher, and I think that one of the reasons that I enjoy blogging so much as someone who has worked in print and is television is the value of your personal printing press to express anger when you're angry about something. And I think that any effective community guideline allows for people to have ferocious disagreements and express that anger and that sense of complete outrage that your opinion's been ignored. I also think that the right community guidelines will embrace the First Amendment. And this is where, as Americans, we're particularly privileged. But my favorite blogging communities are those where multiple opinions are allowed to be fully fleshed out. And the first thing that turns me off in any community is where someone is censured or censored for airing an opinion that is different from the general opinion. That's why on blogger.com we have both a lefty political blogger and a righty political blogger. And when we take on issues like embryonic stem cell research, you can imagine how furious people get. But our goal is having the kind of conversation that we can wake up the next day and actually be proud of without sort of distilling it down into sort of, well, you know.
But keeping it focused on the content. I mean, full disclosure here, I grew up with an ethos that said, which has served me, I guess, respect other people's opinions and also mm-hmm. respect free speech. And the two mm-hmm. almost going hand in hand. That is, mm-hmm. if you respect free speech, then you do respect the other opinion. And if you respect the other opinion, you respect free speech. It's symbiotic. It makes perfect sense.
The issue becomes one of how the respect for the other position, the other person's position, becomes incorporated into the relationship and that you have with that person and into your own position. The ultimate signification of respect is to let someone know that you've heard them. Not only have you heard them, but you've incorporated what they have said into the way you have constructed your own response, and that then builds relationship. So it's not just saying it, but it's receiving it, not necessarily agreeing with it or taking it, but acknowledging that it is something to be put into the construction of one's own particular position.
And but if it's a position that is untenable or that borders on something,
then you give the data and the evidence as to why that is untenable.
But you can also be disdainful. I mean,
sure,
there's nothing
can, yeah.
wrong with being disdainful if it's worthy of disdain.
That's right. That's right. But it's the acknowledgement of the relationship that becomes key. And so to answer the question that I put out earlier, one of the things that tempers or restrains self-interest and respect is relationship, because we value relationship to the point that we will listen and allow the perspective of the other to be incorporated into our perspective and our response and our transformation as self.
You're talking indeed about courtesy and listening, really, and just, I mean, and giving at least a full kind of attentiveness to whatever the other opinion may
and
be.
And then showing how that becomes part of the construction of the public argument.
Yeah. Let me go to more calls. And Peter, it's you. Good morning.
Yes, hi. I think what Tony Hall said happening after the event was interesting, but I wanted to focus on two facts and an opinion. First, it's my understanding from what I read that what was actually said was nothing about the mayor's use or non-use of something, but rather it was said that he had obfuscated about it when asked. The second thing is, in terms of background, the mayor has not come to the supervisors to speak to them monthly as the voters by a majority passed in a ballot measure and said he should do. So it seems to me there are questions of mayoral sort of responsiveness, and how civil is it for a mayor to ignore a ballot measure passed by, I think, 55% of the voters? So I think there's a level of frustration in that essentially people in power don't necessarily, their incivilities don't get noticed.
Forgive me, Peter, is that a question of civility or a question of maybe the use or misuse of power?
Well, that's the point. And the point is that I think that people argue about incivility at times when those who may have a bigger position of power are able to do things that are awful but don't actually look like incivility. And the opinion is that I think there's inadequate media coverage of many of the key issues that we're saying ought to be covered, like the health cuts that really hurt people and which apparently that meeting was about. And that isn't considered incivility either when you cut really important programs and so on and so forth. So I think there needs to be sort of a distinction between actions that are would be incivil if they were expressed in words, but in fact through actions can be very hurtful, versus what might seem incivility but is maybe just a reaction to actions and inadequate coverage.
Peter, I thank you for your call. Good to hear from you this morning. And let me hear from another caller, and that's you, Thomas. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I would just like to thank you very much for having a show on this topic. And I would truly urge you to revisit this topic frequently, perhaps on a monthly basis, because I think it's at the heart of what we need to solve as a democracy in America, and to build a stronger sense of community. And
in this case, Thomas, I like to think the medium is the message because we try to do a civil talk show every day as much as we can.
Yes, but what I was going to also urge as a tangible takeaway is that those panelists who are either in public service or in education strive to try to bring this topic, greater emphasis in the classroom as low as elementary school with a reinvigoration of civics and debate, because I think our young future voters need to grow up with experience of putting themselves in the shoes of people who they don't understand or perhaps disagree with, yet in a friendly environment. I believe it's Plato, I think, who spoke about, being truly good or a good man is to be able to argue the views of your opponent as passionately and as effectively as your own. And the last caller, I think, hit it on the head at some level, is that a lot of what perhaps transpires in our public service realm is that politicians abuse their power, and they abuse it in opaque ways. And what is
sometimes seen, in very transparent ways.
Well, yeah, and other than it, what's seen as a response is uncivil is, in fact, it's civil disobedience. And what is the nature of civil disobedience, and when is it justifiable, given the context of what may or may not be known by the general public, who is often driven by, as other callers said, passionate sound bites and the way our political system and machines are funded in their mere existence. So I just thank you very much and hope to hear follow-up talk shows on the subject.
Well, thank you, Thomas. Appreciate hearing from you. And we've actually come to the close of this hour. I think the message is pretty loud and clear, though. Be civil, and that not only applies to our politicians as much as it can within public discourse, but also with respect to the media, with respect to the blogosphere, with respect to just everyday life. I want to thank our guest, Jim Donahue from the GTU, who's president and professor of ethics at the Graduate Theological Union. Thanks, Jim, for being with
us.
Thank
you, Michael.
And thanks, Lisa Stone, co-founder of BlogHer. That's BlogHer, a women's media company in Palo Alto. Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks.
Thanks also to Don Hanlon Johnson, who joined us earlier on, author of Everyday Hopes, Utopian Dreams, and former supervisor Tony Hall and supervisor Michaela Alioto-Peer. Another hour of Forum coming your way. In the hour ahead, we're going to talk to veteran journalist and Bay Area-based journalist David Talbot about his book on the Kennedy brothers, with a lot of revelations that may indeed surprise and dismay. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory, and with production assistance from Christina Shaheen and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.